Welcome to Lit with Charles, a podcast on all things literary where I interview people who've either written books or have interesting things to say about them. If you're like me, then you love reading, but maybe you're not sure what you should be reading, or maybe you feel intimidated by conversations around books. The main aim of this podcast is to make literature exciting and accessible, and hopefully make you discover new books and authors that are off the beaten track. In this podcast, I try to cover all genres and types of books, from serious historical nonfiction to trashy novels, and I talk to all sorts of authors so that it never feels like the same episode twice.
It's one of those books that takes you back to the way you read as a teenager, where you would just take a book and you would go and you would curl up and that book would just be your world. As an adult, it's harder, I think, to find books that really capture you in the same way. But Lonesome Dove is one of those books.
Cowboys, golden dust plains, and wide open spaces. This is the stuff of the Far West, a setting that has been visited and revisited in literature and film, often pitting good versus evil in stark terms. And today I'm talking about one of the greatest novels of the American West, Lonesome Dove, by the Texan author Larry McMurtry, published in 1985. This epic book explores and unpacks the mythology of the American West in a gritty and innovative way. The narrative follows the story of an epic cattle drive across the USA from Texas to Montana, filled with danger and personal conflicts. Tonally, it's a blend of harshly realistic depictions of life as a cowboy, with moments of camaraderie, levity, and of course, discovery. The book's protagonists are two old cowboys, Woodrow F. Call and Augustus McRae, two very complex characters who are the odd couple driving the novel. One might even describe them as narrative foils. Captain Call is stoic and duty-bound, shaped by a harsh upbringing and the demands of frontier life. Augustus McRae, on the other hand, is more laid-back and easygoing, expressive and motivated by a desire to enjoy life and find pleasure in its journey. What they have in common is a youth spent as Texas Rangers, where they excelled at fighting anyone standing in the way of law and order, be they local outlaws, Mexican bandits, or indigenous warriors. The book received huge praise and widespread critical acclaim when it came out, winning McMurtry the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction in 1986, and it is considered an absolute masterpiece in the canon of Western literature. I can't recommend it enough. Sadly, Larry McMurtry passed away in 2021, so even if I'd wanted to, I couldn't have interviewed him. But I got the next best thing. One of the book's biggest fans and the person who recommended it to me. In today's episode, I speak to Kate Slotover, co-founder of the Book Club Review, a book club in podcast form which loves debates and discussions about a work that we're both huge fans of. While I was reading it, I knew that Kate would be the perfect person to discuss it with. In this episode, we're going to really narrow in on some of our favorite moments, specifics, and characters for an in-depth and exciting discussion of this very special book. If you haven't checked out her excellent podcast, The Book Club Review, then I suggest you have a listen. It's absolutely brilliant. Where should we begin? How does one begin talking about this absolute masterpiece? I suppose I should begin by thanking you for recommending this book to me because I absolutely loved it. And you kept recommending it to me and I kept putting it off. And finally, I picked it up and loved it. Do you have the same trouble I have in convincing others to pick it up and read it? Or are you also finding reluctant partners in reading?
Well, there's a couple of things that put people off. One is the very obvious one, which is this is an absolute brick of a book. It is
a brick. How many pages?
815? My edition is 842 pages.
There we go.
So it's a commitment read. And I think even readers are busy, you know? There's kind of a thing, isn't there? You know, we're also busy. And the lure of a kind of between 200 and 300 page read that you can just read, experience, but then, you know, the thrill of finishing, moving on to the next book, you know, that's just nice, isn't it?
But it's not just that, maybe, because on your podcast episode, your podcast partner, Laura, She didn't enjoy the book very much. She had issues, I think, with the violence in the book. And do you think that's something that puts people off from getting into this world of gritty Western men and gunfights and all of that?
It's a funny one because it was interesting seeing it through her eyes. And I was reminded in a way that I had kind of forgotten actually just how dark and violent it is. And Larry McMurtry knew this. He always was quite open about the fact that he had never set out to write this, what it became described as Gone with the Wind of the West, you know, with a kind of romanticism that implies, you know, that was not really what he was after. He was interested in the reality of the West and kind of interrogating that idea of the era of the cowboy and the conquering of the land in a really interesting way. But of course, as part and parcel of that is a lot of poverty, violence. There is some truly horrifying violence against women and against children in this.
Yeah.
Which I think was Laura's kind of point at which she felt she kind of had to step away for a bit, although she did go back. But the thing is, the kind of narrative is so compelling, and that voice that keeps you going through it and these characters just sweeps you along. And so although I was aware of those things, it wasn't like I didn't notice them, it didn't stop me from enjoying this book. And that's really interesting, isn't it? What is the magic of this book?
What is the magic of this book? And you just used the word voice, and I think that's maybe an interesting starting point. What is it about the voice? I mean, it's very simple prose. It's almost too simple. It's sometimes very literal. Like there's not much room for poetic interpretation, I felt. Sometimes I was like, you know, he's describing a scene and you're like, I get it. It's very literal. And yet it is kind of magical and it does transport you. What did you make of the voice?
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because it's not obvious how he's doing it.
Mm.
It seems quite simply written. There's a directness to it. There's also this incredible warmth and charm to all of these characters. And what he has, and what I thought when I read it, it just reminded me of the way I feel about Tolstoy in War and Peace in particular, which is the one of his that I really love and have read several times, is his gift for character. You know, in just a line, Tolstoy can sketch someone and they're there as like a fully realized individual. Yeah, I always was so kind of in awe of his ability to do this. And it makes me laugh in War and Peace. There's one point where he even does it with a horse. There's at one point you see a scene from the point of view of the horse. And it always makes me laugh when you get to that, because even the horse, you're like, yes, this horse has hopes and dreams and feelings. And you go along with it because it's so beautifully done. And I think McMurtry has the same thing. You know, even his minor characters, the kind of bit players who are on the fringes of the main story,
every single one of them pops out. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously the major ones really live and exist, especially the two main characters. But even the, you know, some of the hands that work on this drive, minor characters really come out. And he ascribes such great personalities to all of them. And again, I don't quite know how he's doing it. I'm not quite sure what the trick is as he's doing it.
I think part of it is that you don't necessarily like them all that much when you first meet them. They're full of light and shade. They're all incredibly complex. They do good things. They do bad things. They have honorable motives and sometimes they don't. And also characters grow and change through the course of this book. And you get to kind of go on this journey with them. And the thing about Gus and Call, for the first 250, 300 pages of this book, I really wasn't that interested in them. I didn't really like them that much. It was definitely not like from the first page. I was like, oh my gosh, these two men are so extraordinary. All I want to do is find out what happens to them. It was a long old while before I really started to feel invested in what happened to them, because you have to get to know them. And I love that he has the confidence as a writer to say, you've got to get to know these two men and it's going to take some time. So off we go.
So maybe it's that confidence that's attractive, this quiet leading you down and don't worry about it. This is going to be great.
I think so. I think I read somewhere he deliberately set out to make this as long as it was. Because originally, of course, the idea was a screenplay for a film, a Hollywood film that he wanted to make with the director, Peter Bogdanovich, about the idea of the Western, the kind of end of the West. And he was hoping to get John Wayne, Henry Fonda, and they couldn't get Wayne, who understandably looked at this supposed Western this is someone whose, you know, career was built on these films that kind of glorified the idea of the cowboy and the taming of the West. And he looked at this part and unsurprisingly was just, well, that's not for me. And so he never signed up to it. Because it is, by its very nature, it's both a kind of celebration of some aspects of this time and the landscape and American history, and also a critique, quite a pointed critique of this mythology.
I fell in love with those main characters fairly early on. That whole episode where they're stealing horses in Mexico, I already had a lot of affinity for the two of them. And I have to say, I loved how that story essentially went nowhere. I thought that was going to be the drive of the story, that this Mexican bandit, I don't want to give too much away, but I thought he was going to be sort of the main pursuer of the story, but actually he kind of disappears. And I really loved that. I thought it was kind of cool that, okay, we're not going to go down that way. We're going to thrust the story in a different direction.
Yeah, because they head off over the Texan border, don't they? And they kind of help themselves to some cattle that it seems are just sort of milling around down there. But of course, they're not just milling around. They belong to people.
Exactly.
And so they do this raid and they get their cattle and then they set off on this drive to get them up to Montana. And for me, they encounter this sandstorm. You know, they're kind of setting off and you've got, by this point, the main group of characters are all together. And this sandstorm blows up. And it's written in this incredible kind of cinematic way. And I just suddenly realized, like, oh my God, I have to know what happens next. And from that point, which I think kicks in, it was about 350 pages in, I was deeply invested and I really did care. And after that, I kind of sat back and enjoyed the ride. It's got a kind of Dickens, it's very eventful. It goes from kind of scene to scene. There's a chase, there are villains, there's surprises. There are moments where you think everything's all settled down and you can relax. And then suddenly something else happens and it's all high drama again. And there's also there are these emotional arcs that are going on. There's this friendship, this complex relationship and friendship between these two men, Gus and Cole, who are in their, what would you say, 60s?
Early 60s. I wondered how old these guys were. Early 60s. And they are the perfect odd couple. They complement each other perfectly. They're bickering like an old couple, and it's just an incredible relationship. And both of them really pop out of that relationship.
I remember hearing him say that over the course of the book, what happens, as indeed with a lot of close relationships, is that they start to rub off on each other. So at the beginning, when you first meet them, they're quite clearly defined in their sort of separate identities. And Gus is the talkative, fun-loving one, I suppose. He loves a joke. He doesn't like to work too hard. He likes to relax. He likes to have fun. And Cole is the very morally upright, stern,
puritanical.
Exactly, the kind of moral center. And he's got this such a rigorous code of personal ethics that he doesn't step outside. And over the course of this long book, what starts to happen is that Gus becomes a little bit more concerned about the morality and ethics of various things, and Cole slightly softens. I mean, I think the point is it never really happens. They never really meld. And I think perhaps the almost tension of that is another of the things that keeps you going.
Yeah. There's a direction of travel that you wonder if they're ever going to reach the end of that arc in their character development. Somebody mentioned to me in the preface of a later edition, Larry McMurtry labeled Cole as a Stoic and Gus as an Epicurean. So there's a sort of ancient Greek connection there. Maybe this is, do you think he was sort of, I don't know, mining that material, philosophical material to showcase, I don't know, different avenues of building characters?
I think this is another thing that you sense when you read it, is to go back to the way it's written in this seemingly quite simple sort of folksy way. I mean, it isn't, but it feels a bit like that because obviously that's what he was crafting. And yet at the same time, you sense that it's been written by someone very bright, someone who has this background in literature and is interested in philosophy and likes the idea of playing around with one of the characters, trying to put something in Latin on a sign. Gus does this at one point, doesn't he, at the beginning?
You love that sign. Let's talk about the sign. This is, I think, one of your favorite subjects. In your episode, you refer back to the sign. What is it that you love so much about that sign story?
Well, at the beginning, it's sort of setting up the outfit that these two have ended up running, which is called the Hat Creek Cattle Company.
In Lonesome Dove, Texas.
In Lonesome Dove, which is this, you couldn't even call it a town. It's a scratching of a settlement.
It's a shithole. Let's call it what it is.
And vividly describing the sun beats down. It's so hot. There's nothing there. I think there's a funny line about, because Gus puts all this effort into making this sign. I wonder if I've still got the page folded from when we talked about it before. My copy of Lonesome Dove is so incredibly dog-eared. I read it when I was on holiday, you know, so at one point a corner of it may even have sort of dropped in the pool because yeah. It's definitely got a bit of water damage. But yeah, no, he puts up this sign, and on the sign it lists all the things that they do.
All the services that they provide.
That they're offering.
Yeah.
And at the end, he has this idea.
Including the fact that they don't rent pigs, if I remember your episode correctly.
That's right.
That's sort of a major thing.
We don't rent pigs. And Cole said, well, you know, why would anyone want to rent a pig?
Nobody rents pigs.
But Gus just wants to make this very clear. And then at the end, he decides he wants to put on this line of Latin. Can you remember what line?
I've got it right here.
Have you got it?
The line is, uva uvam vivendo varia fit, which of course you and I both know means a grape changes color when it sees another grape. So it's a completely nonsensical sign, but Gus seems to think that it'll give this Hat Creek outfit a little bit of class, maybe a little bit of polish.
I think so. I think Lonesome Dove, you know, theorists, people who really like to go on a deep dive, speculate that this, even though it's not a phrase in Latin that actually really makes any sense, possibly is tying into this idea of these two personalities gradually rubbing off on one another, you know, this idea of the grape ripening with the other grapes, and that there is like a kind of a bit of a change that goes on. And, you know, you could argue that then you see this bear out in the relationship between these two characters.
Kate, it sounds like you've gone into like some deep Lonesome Dove Nerdfest forums. There are some Reddit subgroups on Lonesome Dove. Have you been on that expedition? Or?
Well, I was curious and I looked it up because I didn't do Latin at school and I had no idea what uva, uvam, vivendo, varia, fit meant. And I was curious. So I then found a very helpful Reddit thread where they'd done the deep dive for me. And one of these brilliant ones where all these classicists were kind of weighing in with the real, like, well, this is not really correct because blah, blah, blah. But then other people are thinking, well, maybe this is why he used it.
The point is not that it's correct or incorrect, I think. It's just
well, the point is, why does Larry McMurtry, with this cowboy character, why is he introducing the idea of Latin at all? Mm. And that possibly is tying into this idea that book learning was not helpful to these people. This kind of intellectual life of the mind world of learning was in no way helpful to Gus. And in fact, Gus, he has this Latin primer that he is a textbook that he's inherited from his father. And the joke about it is that the lessons are sequential. And the idea is that by the time you get to the end of the book, you would be able to translate some of the Latin. But Gus is caught out in the plains one day and he has to burn it to keep warm. He burns the second half of the book. And so he never gets to the point where he knows what uvam vivendo varia fit means.
But, you know, after I listened to your episode, I did think about that Latin sign. And it does serve a function with regard to the plot and specifically to connect to another character, which is that cowboy whose name escapes me now. But this very gentlemanly cowboy who does call them out on the nonsensical aspect of the sign. And then he reappears later on in the book. He's a victim of that gangster posse. And I think Gus even says something along the lines of, he's the only man who attended Yale College and is buried in the far west after a gunfight. Mm. And so that connection of two worlds of the Yale educated person and these rough cowboys who just get killed in gunfights, and that this character who is introduced thanks to the sign is introduced into the story.
But I think that's McMurtry. I think McMurtry grew up in this small Texas town where it was not the norm that people would go off to college or maybe be great readers, or in his family in particular, who I think were a kind of ranching family, because then his knowledge of cowboys and that history came from his own family history.
Wow. So he's representing himself maybe in various aspects of the book, perhaps.
Well, right. But he did love to read, and he did go to college, and he studied literature, and he read all the great novelists. And not only that, he read critical theory, carried on his academic career. He then taught literature. At one point, he gets tenure at Rice University, I think. But
oh, wow.
At that point, his writing career is sort of taken off. And so he never takes up on it, which I thought was funny.
Which is such a McMurtry thing to do, of course. And he also had, I think, a book business. I think he'd opened a couple of libraries or even had a chain, maybe. Or no, I'm not sure.
He described himself as a bookman, and he opened a bookstore. He wrote a series of memoirs. And one of the things that I love about him is, I feel like me a bit, he loved to compartmentalize. So instead of writing just one memoir that covered everything, although I think actually one of his novels is autobiographical, and I think a lot of it is in there. But anyway, for these books, he split it up into three. And so one is about his life as a book collector and book dealer. One is about his writing life, which is called Literary Life. And then a third is about his Hollywood life, which was a huge part of his career and the thing that made him all the money. It wasn't the novels that made him successful financially. It was the fact that so many of them were then picked up and made into Hollywood films.
Wow.
But books, a memoir, is the one where he talks very specifically about this book side of his life. And he loved the idea of Hay-on-Wye, the book town, which we have here in the UK, which is this town,
of course,
all about books. And he wanted to kind of make Archer City in Texas into the same thing, a book town. So he had this, I think at one point, more than one of these huge kind of warehouses full of books. And back in the day, can you imagine? You just go there and all of these books. I think it's still going, but of course he died a couple of years ago, didn't he?
Yeah, right after COVID, I think.
Yeah, and I'm not sure. I feel like perhaps it's not clear if they're going to carry on keeping it going, or I don't know.
But what a character he was, and a prolific author. Another quick side note, have you read the rest of the Lonesome Dove series? Because there are numerous books, I think four in total in the series. And some of them are prequels to when Gus and Call are young men, are Army Rangers kicking ass around the Far West. And I don't know if they're any good or not. Have you read any of them?
I haven't. My friend Andy in my book club has. He, I think, was happy enough to have read them, but he says they're not nearly as good as Lonesome Dove. And because I suspected that, and for me, Lonesome Dove was such a perfect, complete reading experience. You know, I was thinking about it earlier as I cycled home, and I was thinking, it's one of those books, and they don't come along very often, that takes you back to the way you read as a teenager, you know, where you would just take a book and you would go and you would curl up and that book would just be your world and you would live and breathe it and just do nothing else but read it. You know, you'd maybe go and eat dinner and then you'd go back and you'd read some more and you'd stay up late or you'd have your torch under the covers so you could carry on reading. And as an adult, it's harder, I think, to find books that really capture you in the same way.
Absolutely.
Because I think we, as we read more widely and we just get more experience, we're kind of able to see through things a little bit more maybe, and it's hard to be so swept away. But they do come along, those books. Anyone listening to this, you know the books when they've come along for you. Lonesome Dove is one of those books. I think if it works for you, and it's true, it's not going to work for everyone. It didn't work for Laura. But if it works for you, it is going to be one of those books that's going to take you on that journey. And there is just such pleasure in that because those books do not come along very often.
That's true. So we've talked briefly about the characters. We've talked briefly about the history. I think in terms of the setting, I was kind of shocked at the anarchy of it and the lack of social structure. For example, at various points in the book, a character is hungry and you think, oh, well, you know, just go to the next town and go to the general store or whatever. But no, the solution there is to hunt for some varmint and roast it over your campfire. And that's how they did things there. And it's somewhat prehistoric. It's nasty, brutish, and short. At any moment, somebody can pop out of the bushes and execute you. And so in that sense, I thought that was super interesting. I mean, what did you make of this setting that was almost prehistoric at times?
I think you're right in that it's presented as a hostile environment, which also is incredibly arbitrary. You know, the men or the humans who are in this environment, they have no control over what happens. massive sandstorms come along. They cross a river and it's full of poisonous snakes, you know.
Oh my God, the poisonous snakes was just like unlucky.
But it's sort of tapping into this idea, I think, again, coming back to that idea about the mythology of the West and the cowboy is one of control, right? It's taming the West. And what McMurtry is trying to show is that it really wasn't like that. It was luck and happenstance. And you know, not to say that there was no skill, but it's that interesting thing about what was the most important thing. Was it how good a cowboy was with a gun, or was it whether he had a good horse and was good at riding and had it like a good kind of relationship with the horse, which arguably would be more useful to him? I think he sort of shows that the characters who are adaptable, who are quick thinking, who can react practically and quickly in different situations are the ones who tend to do best, tend to fare the best. But also, yeah, this sort of arbitrary nature. And perhaps in a way, that's where there's a kind of kinship with McCarthy's writing and what he was interested in. I think McMurtry was interested in more than that. And the flip side to this are the occasional glimpses into more settled domestic environments, in particular this relationship with Clara. She is the woman that Gus once thought he was going to be the one that he would marry, but she turned him down. She had some insight, I think, at that moment into what sort of man Gus was and the sort of life she might lead with him. And she decided that that was not the path, that she didn't want to choose the adventurous path. She wanted to choose the safe path. She wanted to settle down and have a quiet life. And so when we meet her, she has done that. But of course, this is, you know, McMurtry land, so fate has cruelly struck her, and she's, her husband is gravely ill, and she has lost children to illness, and she's grieving and she's struggling. And yet she has managed to create this homestead that is warm, and there is good food to eat. And for the brief respite for the characters of the novel, it's a safe space where they go more than once. It's this sort of refuge in the storm. And I think it's a bit tricky in some ways, the way that women are positioned in this novel.
Oh, yeah.
The two characters. You know, if you're reading it with a sort of feminist lens, I don't know. It feels
it's
like
a hyper-patriarchy.
I suppose, but and they're shown to be within that. But at the same time, it's funny, I when I read it, I just felt they were such strong characters and he had such respect for them. And they are so central to the narrative. They are so important. Arguably, I think what he's saying is that they are the ones who really did the work of settling the West.
Right.
Even though they're not the main characters here. I mean, Clara is just such a firebrand and more than a match for Gus and Call, and is shown to be. And that, to me, reading that, you know, a woman reading that, I loved reading that. I was great. I was pleased to see that. And that felt right to me.
Laurie's also a very interesting character because she seems to be in a submissive role in society. And yet she is very much driving a lot of her destiny. She's certainly a more sympathetic and stable character than Jake. And I think that contrast is an interesting one. But it's true that he does have a lot of respect for the women, even if they're in roles that one might say are a bit demeaning, especially prostitution, or that seems to be a very important option for a lot of the women in the book.
Well, exactly. I mean, when we first meet her, she's in Lonesome Dove and she is the town whore. That is what she does to get by. But it's also very clearly explained by McMurtry that she had no choice in the way that she came to this position. You know, she was taken away from her family when she was very young, kind of just basically sexual slavery, I suppose, at the behest of various men who kind of came into her life and then passed her on. And this is where she's ended up. She goes on a huge character arc through this story. And I think she's the one who's tricky because she doesn't have as much agency as Clara. She's very much a victim of circumstance throughout the book. She's so vulnerable. And by the end, you've got a character who's been through so much. She's almost kind of hollowed out. And so she felt like collateral damage to me, I suppose. And I think perhaps I had wanted more for her than that. But I think she's written with great respect and care. And I don't believe she's just plonked there in the narrative lightly.
No. She has a super central role to play and she plays it amazingly. And I think the dynamic that she has in her love or crush of Gus and the way she climbs out of that, I think is all the more power to her. Coming back to Clara's house and that oasis of peace and stability in this tempest, I thought it was kind of cool the way all these characters kept bumping into each other in quite coincidental ways. They keep bumping into each other either in the, you know, in nature or at Clara's place or in various towns. They're sort of tracking each other. They miss each other. But I mean, this is a big amount of land that they're covering. I had to look at some of the maps that showcase the journey. This is a lot of land they covered, and yet they keep bumping into each other, and it feels perfectly natural. And the other book that I read like that, that had a lot of coincidental bumping into each other and so on, was Dr. Zhivago. And there it felt kind of contrived, to be honest. And McMurtry makes it seem cosmic. Like they're supposed to meet, and you're going to believe that they do meet, even though they are traveling in a range of, you know, 100,000 square kilometers, they do meet. I thought that was kind of interesting that these random connections add them to the randomness of life.
Yes, I'm sure there's something in there.
I mean, like, I think what that is, we're not sure, but it is cool.
That's the thing. This book is so rich, you know, if you wanted to pursue one aspect of it, like, say, you know, you wanted to write about, yes, like the connections between characters and space and coincidence in Larry McMurtry's Lonesome Dove, I'm sure you've got a very nice PhD thesis right there, you know.
Or two theses, yeah, if you wanted to.
But I think what's lovely is that when you're reading it, you know, you're not really thinking about any of that stuff, because he's such a fantastic storyteller. He has such a gift for just telling a story, characters you care about, and just the nuts and bolts of it. And it's only when you finish it and you sit back and you just like, whoa, you know, and then you're like, how did he do that? Because it doesn't seem like anything clever is happening while you're reading it.
If you could have met him, what would you ask him about Lonesome Dove?
I don't know. I'm very wary of meeting my heroes. Generally speaking, whenever I've met people that I've really liked and admired in my life, I've always been so paralyzed by kind of embarrassment, and you know what I mean? I kind of—
Welcome to life. I mean—
Yeah, I know. It sort of spoils it all for me. Very much prefer to kind of admire people from a distance. But one of the things I really loved about him was, I just love that sense you get of him and his voice. And there's plenty of video around, you know, you can find on YouTube of him talking, and he kind of spoke the way that he wrote as well, you know.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Does he sound seemingly more like Gus or like Carl, do you think?
Probably a mixture of the two. I don't know. He sounds like Larry McMurtry. Maybe that's the thing. You kind of, you don't quite know from the book, because of course the book is fiction. That's the thing. And yet I do think you have this sense of the guiding hand, which is what I really loved. And when you listen to him talking, it's the same, where it sort of seems very straightforward and like he's saying these things very simply. And yet every so often he'll say something and you'll realize there's a very sophisticated, he's referencing some quite sophisticated piece of criticism or history or something.
Mythology or philosophy.
Was just such an interesting man. But I wanted to read, just the sense of humor I think is great. And I wanted to read you this, in this literary life, there's just a funny little bit. It's written in these very short chapters, which I think he does very well, doesn't he? It's a bit like, again, like Tolstoy, just, you know, War and Peace, such a doorstep, totally short chapters that you just power through. You know, he never kind of bogs you down very long. But this is the same. It's these short little vignettes. And I just wanted to read you the one about when he found out he won the Pulitzer.
Oh, wow.
He said, the day I found out that Lonesome Dove had been awarded the Pulitzer Prize, I happened to be lecturing at a small college in Uvalde, Texas. I think I may have been the first writer to speak in Uvalde, home of John Nance Garner, Roosevelt's outspoken vice president for a while, who remarked famously that the vice presidency wasn't worth a bootful of warm spit. There are variant versions, of course. Because they'd never had a speaker before, the college in Uvalde wanted to be sure and get its money's worth, and they did. It was during my half-hour lunch break that I learned about the Pulitzer, a prize about which the writer William H. Gass has some pithy things to say. James was living in San Antonio at the time. That's his son James. James was living in San Antonio at the time. Uvalde was not far, so he came over to help me celebrate, a doomed effort, since I was dead tired from all day lecturing and had to drive to Austin, which was pretty far, to appear on a panel at the LBJ Library in the morning. A confab at which the then mayor of San Antonio, Henry Cisneros, brusquely insulted me. As I was preparing to leave Uvalde, I noticed the marquee of the Holiday Inn where I had been staying. When I arrived, it read, Welcome to Larry McMurtry, author of Terms of Endearment. By the next afternoon, despite a bunch of reporters showing up to interview me, the marquee had already been changed. Now it read, Catfish Special, $3.99. He didn't take himself too seriously. He didn't take life too seriously.
Seems like a dude.
Well, and also, I think he was pretty much for a long time. You know, people didn't really take his work seriously. People didn't consider him a literary writer.
Because probably of the Hollywood connection.
Maybe that's it. And he kept churning out these fantastic books. And I think he sort of got used to it, maybe. But I don't think he ever really stopped minding about the fact that until finally, I guess his credentials were such that, you know, really the literary establishment had to sit up and take notice.
You just mentioned that he wrote Terms of Endearment, which is a very successful Hollywood movie from the early 80s. And so you're pigeonholed. You know, if the screenwriter of a huge movie suddenly starts writing novels, the level of credibility is much less, of course. And you need to win a Pulitzer before people start taking you seriously, I think.
And also, I just think people didn't take seriously a writer who came from Archer City, Texas.
True.
Yeah. And that's just literary snobbery, isn't it?
And literary snobbery of the worst kind.
Exactly.
Kate, we're going to move on now to some quick questions around your literary tastes and recommendations, because you read an enormous amount of books. And I guess my question is, what's the best thing you've read in the last 12 months?
I have been thinking about this because we're coming up to the end of the year and I'm thinking, you know, best of.
Is there an episode on your podcast of the top five, top 10 that you publish every year?
We will. Yeah, we always do an end of year roundup because they're so much fun to make. So yeah, what's going to be on my best of? I really loved a nonfiction book called Monsters by Claire Diderot.
Okay.
It's a fantastic read. It investigates the idea of what do we do with our feelings about art or cultural products, could be music, could be film, could be a book, made by people who have problematic real life biographies.
Of course.
So she starts with Roman Polanski. She absolutely adores his films. She thinks he's the most extraordinary filmmaker, director. But obviously, in real life, things that he did were extremely problematic and difficult. And so what do you do with those feelings about that you have for the work when you know something about the man? Woody Allen, Michael Jackson. She goes back into history, looks at Picasso, Hemingway. And it's not a new problem. But I thought she framed it in a really interesting way, and it felt very fresh. And it's a provocative book, I think, in a really good way. It's a book that poses more questions than it answers. And it's sort of about the fun of the discussion. And you may not agree with her, and I don't think she would expect you to. It's a book about exploring the idea of discussion and debate, and what do we do with our feelings about this, and how do we square this away? And ultimately, there's not necessarily a conclusion as such, but boy, oh boy, did I enjoy the journey. And I think for us, for the podcast, you know, the Book Club Review, the idea of it was always what we loved was the discussions about books. We love the exchange of views. We love to talk about the books we read. You know, the reading is great, but it's almost like that's kind of the sideline. What we really like is the chat. And just getting to exchange those opinions, and maybe you try and persuade someone, why do you think that? Oh, why do you think that kind of thing? I had it with the Booker Prize where we had a shock difference of opinion between me and Phil over a book that I thought was a dead cert to win, and he had a completely different reaction. And that just delighted me.
I'm reading it right now. Prophet Song.
The winner. Prophet Song, yes.
Yeah. Not a huge fan, I've got to say.
It's not an easy read. It's such an emotionally devastating book. And I think it was written with that intent very clearly.
Okay. I haven't got to the bit that's devastating, because right now I'm sort of, it's not really touching me as much as I would have expected. But let me finish it.
Well, it was interesting because what I thought was, I think if you're feeling robust and kind of happy and confident and sorted in your life, I think you'd be able to weather this book better. I think certainly for me, I feel like increasingly I'm living in a state of some anxiety about the world and certainly my family and you know, the children that I'm responsible for. And that's sort of always bubbling away in the background. And I think this is a book that it is what it is. It's words on a page. But what it taps into is that in a way that really is quite remarkably powerful and direct. And that's why for me, I found it so soul-shattering to read, because it forces you to confront things that I think most of the time we try, just for a sense of our own self-preservation, to not dwell on too much, because otherwise you just can't go on. And my problem with it, if I had one, was I thought it was excellent. I thought it was such fine writing. But my problem with it was where he leaves you at the end.
Don't tell me. I haven't finished it yet.
No, not to spoil the plot, but, you know, it didn't give me anything.
I see.
Unlike, say, you know, Lonesome Dove doesn't exactly have a happy ending.
No.
But you're left with something so remarkable, I think.
Sincere. Real.
Yeah. Lonesome Dove gives you something.
Kate, it was such a pleasure to chat about a book that we're both huge fans of. And again, thank you so much for recommending this book to me. I can't recommend it enough to other people. And I just loved being able to exchange about this book. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having me. Always a delight.
In today's episode, other than the obvious book, we only spoke about a few books. The best book that Kate had read in the last 12 months was Monsters, A Fan's Dilemma by Claire Dederer, published in 2023. It's a topical exploration of whether or not we can separate the art from the artist. We also discussed the recent Booker Prize winner, Prophet Song, published in 2023 by the Irish author Paul Lynch. It's a dystopian book which tells the story of the Republic of Ireland slipping into a totalitarian regime. Kate loved it, but I have to admit it wasn't really my cup of tea. Check out my review of it on my Instagram page. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Lit with Charles. If you have any suggestions or comments, you can always DM me on my Instagram account at @LitWithCharles. I try to reply to all my DMs. If you enjoyed this episode, you should definitely subscribe or follow me, and more importantly, tell your friends and family.